You're on KCSB 91.9 FM, Santa Barbara. Welcome to Radio Causeway. I'm Pav.
I'm Tim. This is your weekly showcase, bringing you timely interviews and bridging your world of music.
From the ingenious dexterity of jazz to the stripped-down nature of improv comedy, our conventional understanding of improv might belie its complexity as an aesthetic practice. Here to help track the history of improvisation and its influence on modern poetics is Dr. Robert Wallace, author of the forthcoming Improvisation and the Making of American Literary Modernism.
And later in the show, we've got music from a band that will be performing live on Radio Causeway. Stay tuned. Good morning. You are on KCSB in Santa Barbara. This is Radio Causeway. I'm Tim.
And I'm Pav. We're here in the studio today with Dr. Robert Wallace, a teaching fellow at the College of Creative Studies and lecturer in the English and Music departments. And he's here to talk with us about his forthcoming book, Improvisation and the Making of American Literary Modernism, as well as his own practice as a musician. Hey, Rob.
Greetings. Hello, Tim. Hello, Pav. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So, you've got an upcoming book, Improvisation and the Making of American.
It's a mouthful. Yeah.
And the Making of American Literary Modernism. Kind of like to get started with just some building block questions. What do you mean by modernism?
Great question. Yeah, I suppose the two sort of key terms in this book, which I think actually will be interesting to more people than just literature professors, hopefully, are modernism and improvisation. Modernism means different things depending on who you talk to, similar to the word improvisation. The way I'm using it is kind of how it comes out of the literary scholarship world. And when we say modernism, we generally mean a period, although that's also arguable. All of these things are arguable, I suppose. But we're usually speaking of a period of aesthetic practice in writing, in music, in architecture, in painting, in dance, in film, that stretches roughly between the late 19th century to the middle of the 20th century. Although now with some hindsight on the entire 20th century, many scholars have started to think of modernism as more of a sort of collection of, as one of my mentors here, Giles Gunn, says, a collection of energies that were sort of unlocked in the early 20th century, which still have great relevance for today's culture. And so in that sense, we can look at maybe certain aesthetic tendencies in various kinds of art and label them as modernist. Of course, the sort of the red flag that comes up, or the elephant that wanders into this room in this discussion inevitably is, well, what about postmodernism, right? If there's something called modernism, something called postmodernism, isn't modernism done? Aren't we done with that? And again, sort of one interesting thing that's happened in the scholarly world over the last, I would say, 20 years or so is sort of a reassessment of that debate and just whether or not the thing that was modernism, or the collection of energies that was modernism, ever died off.
Right.
I think now I would say most people, this is again arguable, but most people I think would be saying that the things that we talk about when we talk about modernism, to paraphrase Raymond Carver, and the things we talk about when we talk about postmodernism are all still very relevant for understanding various sociocultural, political, ethical, spiritual dimensions of contemporary life, regardless if we're looking at modernism as a specific period or a collection of aesthetic tendencies. Okay, so all that said and done, I think there are some really interesting things about the modernist period, if we're looking at it as a period, that do separate it from previous generations of art and culture. And one of the most important things, actually, which is germane to sort of why we're here actually today, is the invention of recorded sound, the invention of new technologies that allowed information to flow more freely and give people more access all around the globe. So, you know, we think a lot these days about the internet and the information economy, but at the turn of the century, you had a similar revolution in technologies that really transformed life as we know it in many ways. So recorded sound was one of those, film was one of those, radio obviously eventually was one of those, and then things like television, but also greater mass transportation, and also things like war, increased technological developments that enabled people to be more brutal to each other, more efficiently. All of those developments really marked the early 20th century as a new period, right? So inevitably, when you're looking for, let's say, in some kind of aesthetic marker to say, okay, this is modernist, or this is romanticism or something, or this is Renaissance literature, right, you can always sort of find it in another period and say, oh, I got you. You know, what about this? Right. Chaucer's postmodern because, you know, he's fragmentary or something like that. So, but I think the one thing that is really interesting about modernism as a period that really does set it off is, at least one thing, is this new kind of consciousness-changing technological innovation that influenced the artistic practices that were happening. And that's really what's sort of the main interest in my world, and thinking about how those developments influenced and were influenced by the art that was happening in the early 20th century, mid-20th century.
Then in terms of these kind of technological developments in that you're kind of sourcing to modern culture, early 20th century culture, how do they fit in with improvisation, or, I mean, in terms of informing improvisation as a practice and as an aesthetic that you then find in modernist literature?
Yeah, again, improvisation is one of these very tricky, confused, and confusing terms that gets bandied about a lot in different contexts. But from my perspective, what's interesting about improvisation when we're talking about modernism is that the musical forms that we now call jazz, blues, even rock and roll, basically any American popular music that you can think of that is now very influential globally, starts to arise during this period, during the late 19th century, early 20th century. And most of those musical forms engage in a practice that we could loosely call, or very specifically call, improvisation, right? As opposed to predominant Western classical music, quote-unquote art music, which at that point had a heavy emphasis on very strictly composed processes. The difficult thing, though, in talking about improvisation is that sort of the layperson's definition, I think, of improv is that it's completely spontaneous, completely free, no pre-planning. It's off the cuff. You're just going for it, right? And I think that the interesting thing that you find when you really start, well, doing improvisation, at least in a musical setting, and sort of studying what it might involve, is that it's a lot more complicated. There's a lot more structure. There's a lot more planning and practice involved than sort of usually gets described when we're thinking about improvisation. So I guess one way of talking about it, and this is something that really became clear to me actually while I was taking a class here at UCSB many years back, well, not many years back, but a few years back with Sidney Levy and Jocelyn Holland over in comparative literature, is that improvisation really exists on a spectrum. If you could have something sort of like pure improvisation or pure composition, on either side of the spectrum, both of those things being impossible, really all artistic practice and all life practice essentially exists somewhere on that spectrum, more or less improvised, more or less composed, fixed, static, as opposed to sort of fluid and dynamic. Okay, so with that model in mind, the really fascinating thing about 20th century art coming out of the United States, particularly when we think of music, is that there's this major shift in consciousness in terms of what people are listening to and what kind of art is getting developed in terms of thinking about improvisation. And that's because of these new art forms coming out of African-American cultural practices like jazz and blues, which become, again, American popular music, right? But it's not just popular in the sense of, oh, it's just what the sort of masses are listening to and the high art culture snobs don't care about it. It was extremely influential at all levels of artistic practice. And so I think, again, this is a really important moment in artistic life, especially in the Americas, especially in the United States. But then because of the kinds of developments in media technology that I was just speaking of, these artistic developments become radically influential across the globe, because now for the first time, this kind of information, recorded sound, and also the ability of musicians to travel becomes so much easier and faster. So this art form then that thrives on improvisatory action becomes extremely popular. Almost from the very moment of its creation. The other important dimension of this, though, is that the artistic practice coming out of these forms of music, or actually the kinds of cultural practices that contributed to these musics coming out of African-American society in the Americas, gives this dimension of improvisation a particularly I think, important ethical context, right? So when we're talking about improvisation as a practice, which I just said pretty much exists in all things that you do every day to some extent, whether in art or in other things that you do, there's a really important dimension of talking about improvisation in an American context. And this is something that has been sort of implied in scholarship by people like Paul Gilroy, whose book The Black Atlantic has been really influential on my work, along with many other scholars. And this is the idea that for African Americans coming out of the experience of slavery, things like music and oral expression, art in general, especially performative art, take on a dimension beyond just being entertainment or sort of blowing off steam. Because when you are denied certain kinds of legal representation, the ability to vote, the ability to hold important positions in business or in government, when you're in fact denied legal status as a citizen in the country that you're supposedly living in and belonging to, then you have to develop alternative forms of communication, of expression, of spiritual practice, of entertainment. But all of these things are sort of wrapped into what we think of as jazz and improvisation in the United States. So again,
don't want to use up all our time on the first part, but speaking of jazz music, you're involved in a few different projects, and we've got some of your music ready to play, so we can, if you can introduce, we're playing the first track that you brought in, if you can introduce the song, and for those that are just tuning in, we're in studio today with Dr. Rob Wallace, a literature fellow in the College of Creative Studies and lecturer in the Department of English and Music at UC Santa Barbara. So what are we about to listen to?
Well, I think we have queued up here a track from a recording that came out in 2008 on the PF Mintum label, which is originally a label based out of Ventura and organized by and run by Jeff Kaiser, a great trumpet player, composer, who's now living in San Diego. And this is, I'm playing drums on this track. This is a group that I played with for a while here in Santa Barbara. One of my main musical conspirators, Mr. Coulter Frazier, a very fine multi-instrumentalist on this music. He's playing the tenor saxophone. And this is a composition that he wrote called Lunch with Osby, which is kind of a reference to the alto saxophonist, jazz composer and musician Greg Osby, who's still making great music, really influential on both Coulter and myself. And this also features Miles Jay on bass and Nick Coventry on viola.
All right. So if you have any questions for Dr. Wallace, you can give us a call when the music's playing. The number is 805-893-2424. It's Radio Causeway. Thank you. You're on Radio Causeway. Today we are in studio with Dr. Rob Wallace, a literature fellow in the College of Creative Studies and lecturer in the Department of English and Music at UC Santa Barbara. He's here talking about his forthcoming book titled Improvisation and the Making of American Literary Modernism.
So you were just talking about some of the kind of the ways in which improvisation is not just aesthetic, but kind of lends itself to thinking about communities or the ethics or the formations of communities. And you trace this really, what I think is a fascinating kind of history of the word, the definitions kind of applied to the word, and then draw out of that some of the kind of the vexed questions or nature of improvisation. Could you share a little bit of like just the early definitions applied to improvisation and what they reflect?
Yeah, certainly. Again, this is it's kind of strange, I think, for a contemporary person to grasp the sort of negative connotations that have been ascribed to this word throughout history. But trust me, it's true. Go check out the Oxford English Dictionary if you doubt me. But really briefly, the word improvisation and its various sort of origins in the Latin substrata of Europe and the various ways in which it's been used, you know, as a word throughout various Romance languages and in English, it's usually associated with something negative, with the con man, with the sense of a person who, again, hasn't planned out everything, but actually has some kind of secret desire or something that they're trying to do that's pulling the wool over your eyes by fooling you with their brilliant rhetoric or something to this effect. So the notion of being an improviser is historically denoted something that you can't really trust, something that's not as good as the pre-planned, scripted, fixed, logical system of art or of philosophy or any other sort of life practice that you want to mention. So this has, again, particularly important consequences for the United States context of improvisation, because the word itself has these historical negative connotations, and by virtue of the fact that the main artistic improvisers, if you will, in the United States were African Americans, you can see how that would quickly become viewed as something negative in terms of the white ruling, white supremacist ruling class of most of the history of the United States. So again, improvisation as a word has this negative connotation, so that when it comes out of African American culture, it's viewed for much of its history by society with suspicion, right? Because it can't be fixed, right? It can't be fully defined, and so it's feared in some sense. But it's also very attractive,
right?
To many people.
Well, you talk specifically about John Cage avoiding the term improvisation,
yeah.
Right? He uses something else. Forgetting the word.
Well, he used a couple of words. Aleatory is one word that mm-hmm. comes up, which just basically means chance, and non-intentional or indeterminate.
Indeterminate. Right.
Cage is a classic example, I think, of and I'm not an expert on Cage by any means, but I think he is a classic example. If you go read what he actually says, he's a classic example of somebody who's citing all of these developments coming out of non-Western musics and African-American musical forms as, you know, the potentially the new future of Western art music, right? And all of these exciting things and percussion music. And in jazz, you know, he talks about hot jazz as was sort of the parlance of the time. But he had a problem with improvisation because he thought that it was too wrapped up in the ego of the performer.
Okay.
But I'm arguing, and this isn't the main argument of this book or anything, but he's symptomatic of a larger sort of trend, I think, in the West, and that is of people who themselves were doing things that by any other name might be called improvisation or a subset of improvisational practice, but couldn't fully sort of use that word to define what they were doing, again, because of this negative history that was associated with the word itself. I think that's part of the larger, more complex sort of developments here. But yeah, Cage is an example of that. There's a great article that has been influential in my thinking on this by George Lewis, who's a jazz trombonist and scholar, called Afrological and Urological. Well, I'm blanking on the exact title, but Afrological and Urological Improvisation is in there in the title. I should know this, but it's now a pretty widely circulated article where he talks about this specific sort of Cage dimension to improvisation.
In your book, you take on American literary modernism, but you particularly focus on four American modernist writers: Ezra Pound, Langston Hughes, Gertrude Stein, and Wallace Stevens. Why these particular writers?
Great question. And if you're scratching your head wondering, you know, what does Ezra Pound or Gertrude Stein or Wallace Stevens have to do with improvisation, read the book. Partly why I did this was precisely to sort of go against the grain and say, if we open up our definition of what improvisation entails, where it comes from, culturally speaking, ethically speaking, in American society, then we can actually see traces of this as a practice and a theory in a lot of different kinds of art that we might not usually associate with improvisation. So somebody like Langston Hughes is probably the most obvious person as a case study that I've used, because he has a direct connection to jazz and to blues and was performing with musicians as a poet. But people like Ezra Pound and Gertrude Stein were also involved in the music world, if not the African-American music world specifically. Mm-hmm. And Wallace Stevens' poetry is filled with references to music and arguably lots of musical writing. Mm-hmm. So I think the key thing that ties all of these poets together for me is their interest in music as a way of structuring reality and also of offering some kind of formal principle for thinking about what they could do in poetry. And what I try to do in the book then is tie that to this larger world of improvisation as it's coming out of American history in terms of African-American aesthetics, but also somebody like William James, who I'm arguing is a philosopher of improvisational practice with his ideas coming out of pragmatism and other works. And there's a sort of a growing body of work that talks about improvisation from this Emersonian, Jamesian perspective. There's a couple of other books that have come out just recently that I actually haven't drawn on too much, but that I think are kind of in this new sort of set of scholarly arguments about the importance of improvisation across the board, again, coming out of African-American culture, but also out of these other places like the philosophy of William James, et cetera. And so all of that stuff sort of gets rolled into these four poets, and they are, I think, very representative of what I'm trying to get at. They're only four examples of a much larger story, but I think because they're so prominent and because they're usually not thought of as people who would be interested in improvisation, with the exception of Langston Hughes, I hope to show that there's a lot more to this story than might be expected, and I hope I've made a convincing argument, but you'll have to go check it out in the book and see for yourself.
Well, there's actually a lot more we could talk about too, but before we do take off, and again, the name of the book is Improvisation and the Making of American Literary Modernism, forthcoming from Continuum Books. That should be out in October.
October, yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the cover?
Yeah, please judge this book by its cover. I'm really, one of the most exciting things about this process has been getting my brother-in-law, Paul Dragone, to paint the cover for me. I had a specially commissioned painting. He's a fantastic painter and artist, and he painted this picture that is now on the cover, and it's kind of a concept that sort of weirdly came out of the book. In each chapter, I ended up talking to some extent about pianos and typewriters. Again, you'll have to read the book to see how and why. But so this painting, Paul's calling it the Thai piano. Not the Thai as in Thailand, but the Thai as in typewriter, the Thai piano. So it's kind of a, you can see it if you check out the book online, you can see the cover, and it's a piano, an upright piano, but instead of piano keys, they're typewriter keys. So I think it's a nice visual metaphor for the kinds of things that I'm talking about in the book.
You can also find pictures and links on radiocausway.org. It's up right now. Before we let you take off, we've got one more song from another project that you're involved in.
Yes, this is, you want to talk about it? This is Ball Hog?
Yeah, this is another sort of facet of my musical interests here in Santa Barbara. This is in typical punk rock fashion. We formed this band, recorded an album, and broke up. And but maybe there'll be a reunion someday. And this project is really special in that not only are all of the band members my good friends, but my wife is also the bassist and one of the singers, Kara Attrip. So I think on this tune she's going to be singing, and this is a particularly, I think, unfortunately still resonant song about the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. But this was a fun band, Ball Hog, and thanks to KCSB in our early formative days for, you know, supporting us.
Well, and the track is Robot Bomb, so.
Correct.
So if you want to catch the entire interview with Dr. Rob Wallace, Literature Fellow at the College of Creative Studies and lecturer in the Department of English and Music at UC Santa Barbara, talking about his forthcoming book, Improvisation and the Making of American Literary Modernism. The podcast will be available later today on radiocausway.org. You can also find links to that on kcsb.org. Dr. Wallace, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Tim and Pav. This has been great, and KCSB is a very special part of my experience here in Santa Barbara, so it's really great to be back always.
Thanks, Rob.
Jet propelled, gyroscopically guided, explosive, gearing, green, and missile. Jet propelled, gyroscopically guided, explosive, gearing, green, and missile.
Radio Causeway is a presentation of KCSB Public Affairs. The opinions expressed were those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of KCSB, the Associated Students, or the Regents of the University of California.
If you have a comment or wish to respond, please address correspondence to KCSB, University Center, Room 3185A, University of California, Santa Barbara, California, 93106. This is KCSB 91.9 FM, Santa Barbara.